Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll talk with Rosemary Avance about her book, Mediated Mormons, Shifting Religious Identities in the Digital Age. In the early to mid-2010s, Mitt Romney's presidential candidacy, the hit Broadway musical The Book of Mormon, and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints' I'm a Mormon media campaign brought critical media attention to Mormonism. In the book, Avance examines Mormon identities as they intersect with their religious institution, the Internet, and modernity during the so-called Mormon moment, and examines how Latter-day Saint stakeholders challenged traditional notions of what it means to be Mormon, vying for control of their own public narratives. Rosemary Avance is an assistant professor of media and strategic communications at Oklahoma State University. Rosemary Avance, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This is exciting.
Interesting book. So I guess, first of all, I want to get into some of your background, which is fascinating, and kind of how you got into this study, the field of studies. Not your only field of study. You do various things in communication, right? But what specifically you're trying to do with this book?
So I knew when I went to grad school that I wanted to study religion and religious identity. I think everybody kind of makes a joke that grad school is sort of like therapy, extended therapy work for people trying to work things out. So I'm from Oklahoma. It's a pretty, you know, religiously conservative area, very evangelical. And I was raised viewing Mormonism as a cult, and using that word to describe it. My family, if my mom saw Mormon missionaries coming down the street, her options in her mind were either like turn off the lights and pretend we're not home, or she was going to challenge them and like pull out her King James Bible and try to have like a Bible, Bible off with them and try to, you know, challenge all their beliefs and convert them. So, I had a view of Mormonism as just sort of very different than my faith that I had been raised in, and I didn't know much about it really beyond that. But when I went to graduate school, the University of Pennsylvania, for my master's and PhD in communication, the area of study that I focused on is really kind of a critical cultural area. It's really comparable, I would say, to sort of the psychology of communication, how it works, why people express things the way that they do, and how doing that creates the reality that we occupy. You know, the way that we talk about who we are and what we believe and what our history is sort of shapes that reality for us. And that was really fascinating to me. And I took a course on it was called The World of the Latter-day Saints. It was in the anthropology department. And was really just fascinated learning more in depth about the sort of life, the life cycle of a typical Mormon person, sort of anthropological life cycle study in that class, you know, from birth until death, of what the life of a Mormon would look like from the institutional perspective, of course. And that was just really fascinating to me because it was so institutional in that perspective. And we were really learning sort of like the, you know, sanitized, idealized, this is, you know, what the stock Mormon would look like. And I knew from reading online and talking to people that it was not that for most people, that most people have a very nuanced experience that's their own and it's individual. And it can be in direct contrast to what the standard expectations might be. And maybe there is sort of like an average experience that we could talk about for a religious group. You know, we could say this is sort of like what most people experience or what it looks like for most people. But for the people that I was speaking to, and I was living in Philadelphia, not the you know, Mormon capital of the world or anything, but everybody's experience was different. Converts, feminist Mormons, gay Mormons, former Mormons. And those experiences were so different than what I was learning about in the class and sort of what official Mormon documents and explanations would say. And I also went through the Mormon missionary discussions at that time. And it was a little different than the traditional experience because my missionary couple was a retired couple that was in the Philadelphia mission, you know, to do work with the local ward, and they didn't typically do the discussions. And so it was a different experience for them and for me as well, because I had never been through the discussions. So I kind of I told them I was taking this course, and they told me, oh, okay, well, is your instructor Mormon? And I told them, no, he's an anthropologist. He studies this. So then they wanted to know what text we were reading, and they kind of wanted to hear what I was hearing, so they would know if I was getting a fair view or if it was, biased against the church. And I remember that the man told me, like, if you want material about the church, we can bring you things. We'll bring you books, we'll bring you pamphlets. You shouldn't just, believe anything you read. There's a lot of anti-Mormon literature out there. And whatever you do, don't Google Joseph Smith, because anything that you see when you do that is not going to be accurate. So that, of course, made me want to Google Joseph Smith. And of course, I had already done that. I was interested. And I knew when you Google Joseph Smith at the time, this is 2011, 2012. I guess it would have been 2010 when I did the missionary discussions. But at the time when you typed in Joseph Smith and you get the little Google suggestion to finish that inquiry, it would say, like, is a polygamist, is a liar, is the Antichrist, or is the prophet of God, and those are sort of your choices to choose from, to how to finish that search inquiry. And so, the church was optimizing search engine results so that their very first sponsored result is the church, and then the first organic result is the church, and then after that, you've got all kinds of different people's opinions. And that was what was really interesting to me, is sort of the contrast between the official accounts and narratives from the church and the kinds of things that people were saying, both people in the church and ch sharing their own experiences, and people from the outside who felt the need to go online and create content to let people know what they thought about this religious identity. So I just started, once you start studying Mormonism, there's so much more to kind of unpack, and you can go down so many pathways of experience and interpretation. The other aspect of all of that is the reason that the missionaries came to our house in the first place. My husband was raised in the church, and in Oklahoma, so a small ward in a rural area. His dad was the bishop for part of the time growing up. And then when he went to college, he didn't go on a mission and kind of diverted from the path. And it caused kind of a lot of emotional and interpersonal drama in his family. And he doesn't identify as Mormon anymore. So the reason we had missionaries coming to find us, knocking on our door in the first place, was because they knew his name and they knew his address and they were looking for him. So I also had that kind of interest, like, what is this about, and what are they gonna be telling me, and what are they trying to accomplish by coming here, and how did they get our address? How do they know we live here? All of these questions. So I had a kind of a personal interest, but also that academic interest to understand, like, representation and why it's such a controversial topic in the first place. Why are there so many people trying to compete to define being Mormon for the world, when you search those terms?
So part of this identity, right, and belonging is the institution itself, right? That's one is, setting boundaries, right, and trying to promote faith and create faith. The other part of this is very fascinating. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this second part of this right now, which is what religion does for people, what people are seeking in religion, and identity is a very important part of that, isn't it?
And I think that in America, especially, people talk about Mormonism as a uniquely American religion, and not just because it's founded in America during a time of, religious fervor, and a lot of different religious organizations got their start, but because it has a lot of, like, American identity center to it. It's kind of, like, culturally very American. It's, patriotic faith. It's kind of intertwined with the history of, or with various histories of, the continent and the country kind of coming into being. And because of that, it has this kind of a cultural appeal and tie-in that a lot of religious experiences don't offer. There's not really a comparable American identity religion in the sense that, some countries you can associate with a faith, Anglicanism you can associate with the, and the Church of England, and Lutheranism is a kind of a German origin story there. Americans, such a hodgepodge, all these different countries, we're kind of a mishmash of people. We have a sort of a cultural identity crisis a lot of the time, I would say. I think we're seeing a lot of that kind of come to a head with a lot of the white supremacist rhetoric that we're hearing more and more of these days. But in the midst of all of that, I think there's sort of this central kind of longing for identities that have a history and like a tradition behind them that we can root ourselves in, and we can sort of see that we are a part of something bigger than ourselves, and that we have like this connection to something that came before. And the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, even though it's a really young religion in terms of its history, it has this tradition, and part of it, part of the cosmology, is this very long history that's tied into the beliefs, where this country started, and Jesus visiting the continent, and kind of tying it into a grander narrative about the place in the world that Mormons can hold. And I think that's just that ties into so much of what Americans sort of are seeking, like a place to belong and a story to be a part of, and in a young country, it's just something that we sort of lack, that a lot of people have. And we want, for the most part, Americans want to have something like that to tie into. So it offers in a lot of ways some of the same emotional and psychological appeal, I would say, as nationalism. Having a, having a nation that you can call your own, and a history that you can tie in through that culture. People do have, obviously, I think it's obvious to say that we all have kind of a desire to belong, and a desire for a community. But I think Mormonism as a system, as an enterprise, kind of ties into something much bigger than just belonging and having a place. It's also connected to every aspect of your life and your identity, and your sort of sacred history that goes, ties back generations and generations, and then genealogical work, and baptisms for ancestors. It just sort of ties everybody together into this much grander narrative that really kind of speaks to that desire for purpose and connection.
In the book, you kind of give a range of what you could call Mormonists, or maybe to use what the church would like, Latter-day Saintness. There's kind of a we're familiar with these, but I wonder if you could take us through some of those.
Yeah. It's funny because I struggled really, and I still struggle to talk about those categories, because kind of one of the main points of my work, I think, is to show that there's not a way of belonging, and whether that's in the church or something else, we are all negotiating and sort of filling social expectations, as well as trying to fulfill our own sense of like who we really are, some kind of internal truth. And so we're all negotiating those things, and there's not just one way to be. And there's also, the categories themselves are like continuums or spectrums. So anyway, to say that, I'm kind of giving a disclaimer. Like I identify some categories in the book, but even those categories I think are false oversimplifications. Like there's not a left and a right. There's a bunch of ways within that. It's more of a circle or a sphere than it is a line of distinction. In the book, I'm really talking kind of about categories of ascent and descent when it comes to the church. So if you take the church's sort of institutional narrative about, what a Mormon should do, how a Mormon should behave, what a Mormon should believe, that would be sort of like the party line. And then the extent to which individual Mormons might agree or disagree, or practice differently, or behave or believe differently, would be their agree of their kind of, the extent to which they assent with the church's narrative or dissent from it. So I talk about communities of dissent, communities or individuals in some cases that are sort of interpreting things differently or challenging things that the church has taught historically or that the church is currently doing in practice, and who envision a Mormon reality that's different, that looks different, in which practice is different. So, for example, there's quite a bit of space devoted to feminist Mormons, and that within feminism and Mormonism, that's a big spectrum too. I met Mormon women who told me they don't use the word feminist. They don't identify as a feminist Mormon, but everything then that they would say about what they think is sort of like feminist perspectives. There are many women who want more visibility for women in leadership in the church, but don't want to upset the sort of overall patriarchal structure. They're not necessarily advocating for women in, priesthood positions or, other, positions of authority over men. So to some extent, they might dissent in some ways, but for the most part, they're happy to continue following the overall structure of the church. But then, of course, there's also women who have vocally advocated for ordination for women and who have, in some cases, been excommunicated for doing so. So those kind of divides within, even within the communities that advocate for more visibility for women, there are so many divides and so many different ways of interpreting what that should look like that it kind of hinders a lot of a collective action that might take place to try to advocate for some of those things. There's not a clear a position that women take either for or against some of those gender norms in the church.
Mm-hmm. And then people present themselves. There are markers. We'll get into talking about caffeine, for example. There are markers where people declare to other members or to the world, this is the kind of Latter-day Saint that I am. And we're going to talk about that, but not only in Latter-day Saint community, right? It's
right.
It's
everything.
You've talked about
religion. I'm a professor. I teach at a school. Oklahoma State is a big kind of fraternity and sorority school. I guess most colleges and universities are. There are, different things that you can associate with different houses on campus, like, different styles of dress or different hair colors or, different even phrases and ways of speaking. So within all the organizations we might be a part of, we try to differentiate and fill a role in ways that give cues about who we are. Even me, I'm getting dressed to go to work as a professor. Maybe I'm going to go teach. I'm going to wear something that looks teachery mm-hmm. a little bit, mm-hmm. but also with a little of my style, because I want to still be myself. I want to be the cool teacher, not the mm-hmm. Weird teacher or whatever. Right. So like I have this kind of identity that I want to communicate. When it comes to religious and sacred kind of identities, often those boundaries that we're kind of demarcating in our behaviors or in our appearance, those often have to do with, communicating where we fall in line with that kind of institutional assent and dissent that I mentioned before. So caffeine was such an interesting thing for me to explore because I was told early and often that caffeine had nothing to do with the word of wisdom and, that Mormons didn't have a belief about caffeine. It was specific coffee and tea and alcohol, drugs. Those things are against the word of wisdom. But caffeine is not part of that. But then when I went to Utah, I think the first time I ever went to Utah was for a conference, and it might have been in 2010. I noticed on BYU's campus that there was no caffeine, and there were beverages I had not heard of from Oklahoma, like diet caffeine-free Coke, which sounds like what is that? When you take away the caffeine and the sugar, you've got, what do you have left? but that was an option in vending machines, and there were no options in any vending machines at that time on campus that had caffeine in them. And so as a non-Mormon visiting the campus, obviously I knew I wasn't going to be able to get coffee to drink, but I thought for sure I could get myself a Dr. Pepper or a Coke and have a little caffeine, but that was not the case. So I had a splitting headache, and I began to talk to people about that. I also noticed at the conference venue, which was off campus, that diet caffeine-free and non-diet caffeine-free Cokes were options to drink. We also had an ice cream social, which I thought was interesting too, because ice cream is a big thing. But I'd never had that happen at an academic conference where there was ice cream available. But yeah, so the caffeine thing is really an interesting line. And I spoke to a professor at BYU about that, and he said, you know, it's not that we can't, it's that, you know, we're just being extra careful. You know, we don't know what it is that makes coffee and tea bad for your body or bad for your spirit, whichever it may be. And because we don't know, and we know that they have that in common, to be extra careful and kind of, you know, not just the letter of the law, but also trying to understand what might be behind that. You know, you can also avoid caffeine. And plus, he said, if I were to walk into my classroom with a Coke in my hand, my students would not respect me anymore. They would no longer think that I was being faithful. And so he was like, even if it wasn't about me being careful, I have to be careful what message I'm sending. And that reminded me of something that a bishop from Philly had said to me about, you know, he doesn't mind to be around people when they're drinking alcohol, but he will always be careful to drink something that doesn't look like alcohol while he's with them, because he doesn't want someone else to see him and think he might be drinking alcohol. So it was not just about not consuming it, it was also about not being perceived to possibly be doing the wrong thing, or you know, doing something risky or rebellious, really, I think. And I remembered that from my own upbringing, like avoiding the appearance of evil and kind of not being a stumbling block to others who might think that you're doing something that you're not supposed to do, or who might see your behavior and interpret that as okay and now do it too, and misinterpret what you were doing in the first place. So, but that's kind of like this, there's this hyper self-awareness that goes into that. You have to be constantly thinking about how you're being perceived by others so that you can kind of have this like, self-perception based on how others are perceiving the things you might be doing and how you could possibly intend them, even if that's not what you intend. And it's almost an obsession, because it becomes very self-limiting. You know, you have to be careful about the things that you do and the ways that you do them, to such an extent that I think that could be it could become impossible to navigate. You know, any beverage can be alcohol. Like, alcohol is clear sometimes and can look like water. So, you know, not drinking any beverage is not really an option. I noticed that this also sort of bled over to garments and modesty for women, especially. The idea of, you know, where the line of your shirt cuts off can be an indicator of whether you're being faithful to your covenant and wearing your garments. And, you know, we've seen that recently since the book, obviously, and since all of this study. But with the introduction of the sleeveless garments for women, and the sort of line of the sleeve has sort of crept up the arm. And there's been a lot of discussion about that, whether, you know, why that would have changed, why that would have been a thing in the first place, if that wasn't intended to be the line of modesty. You know, like, this is where God wants the line of your shirt to end. And I've seen and heard from a lot of women who've felt kind of disappointed about that change, to see that change. And, you know, they felt like they had sacrificed being fashionable in some ways, or you know, dressing in, you know, appropriate attire for the weather if it's hot, because they were trying to be conscientious about modesty, and then it turns out that it's not a modesty thing. I think that felt kind of like a small betrayal for some women. But those lines really have more to do with how you're being perceived than they do about your own self. And I think modesty is always like that, because it's always about not being sexy for someone else. It's not about for your own self. And when it comes to caffeine, that's a kind of an above and beyond thing that, you know, church leaders have intentionally left vague. They've never said to do or not to do, you know, whether this is going to be. And when the church newsroom does talk about that in 2012, the language of the announcement that the church newsroom made was so vague. And then they changed the language of their own announcement to be even more vague. And that just left people very confused. But I think that that is important to allow people to kind of interpret that for themselves, and then also not feel betrayed by the institution. If the church were to come out and say, "We never said anything's wrong with caffeine. Have all the caffeine you want," you know, then all the people who spent their lives not doing it, you know, it kind of feels like that was a waste and it wasn't appreciated. But then on the other hand, you don't want to alienate people who are happy members of the church and they also drink caffeine. And, you know, if that's not a problem for them, then you don't want to make it into a problem. So those lines are just, they're also very geographical. It's very different in Utah for Mormons than it is in Tulsa or Philadelphia. So that was a fun chapter to explore as the kind of caffeine protests sort of went on at BYU, and students were sort of pushing for a little more freedom in their beverage choices.
Let's take a break. We're talking with Rosemary Avance. Her book is Mediated Mormons, Shifting Religious Identities in the Digital Age. We'll have more following this break.
Claudia's pregnant. How should she give birth? She gets advice from her friends and internet message boards, but her car mechanic dad might have the best answer of all.
Every 10 seconds without oxygen, the baby...
Oh! Baby's out!
Oopla! You see?
Bump by Kiara Atik. Next time on LA Theater Works.
Tune in Friday night at 9 here on UPR.
Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members and USU Extension. A recent study examined skills that Utah employers view as critical for workforce success. A report showed how educational programs can better prepare graduates to meet industry needs. Details at extension.usu.edu.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Rosemary Avance, who is Assistant Professor of Media and Strategic Communications at Oklahoma State University. And her book is Mediated Mormons, Shifting Religious Identities in the Digital Age, focusing on the Mormon moment of the early 2010s. I like this description of the book. Avance's book sheds important light on how Mormons specifically, but other religious groups generally, build, challenge, and live out their religious identities in the digital age. We're talking about how fellow members present to each other the message that you know, caffeine or not drinking caffeine and clothing, etc. Reminded me of something you've said about your evangelical Christian background, but very similar, I imagine, to Latter-day Saint Ward. The women are supposed to have their dresses below the knee, but some women go even further, and that's kind of a marker, a message to other members of that church. I'm especially modest. I'm especially Orthodox.
Right. Yeah. And it'll vary, of course, between every denomination where those lines are and what would be considered, you know, especially Orthodox. So, you know, in some churches, you know, covering the knee is expected, but then covering the shin would be extra. But then in others, you know, the knee is not a big deal either way. It's specific to the community. It's a language, really, the way we kind of tell other people about who we are and where we fall within the spectrum of practice and belief in our own communities. And that's true of beyond religion. It's not just a religious practice and it's not just clothing. It's all the things about ourselves. The church that I was a part of as a teenager, you know, women didn't wear makeup at all or jewelry. And it was, the idea was to not adorn yourself. But, you know, if you looked closely, there was some concealer happening and there was, you know, maybe a little mascara happening. The idea was that it shouldn't be visible, like you shouldn't know that it's happening. So even if we knew it was happening, we also were supposed to like pretend like this was just the natural look of our faces. So But the extent to which you do or don't participate in those kind of workarounds is a signal about, you know, what is valued by you and also where you stand in terms of loyalty to the organization and the kind of principles behind it.
You've talked about some churches emphasize what we believe, others emphasize mm-hmm. what we do, others
yeah,
a combination
yeah.
of the both. Give me yeah. a variety of that, and let me talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the concepts there are orthodoxy and orthopraxy. So orthopraxy has to do with doing the right things, and orthodoxy has to do with believing the right things. And some faiths emphasize one or the other, and it really doesn't matter. Like, you know, Judaism is the classical example that we think of when we think of orthodoxy being, you know, the beliefs. We think of, you know, rabbinical, very conservative groups that practice certain things and believe certain things. But really what we're talking about, even if we say orthodox or not, reformed, I guess, we're really talking about orthopraxy, because it has to do with the rituals and the behaviors and the observances, the kinds of things that you do on a daily basis to indicate that you belong or don't belong. And, you know, if you talk to Jewish people, you know, you'll find such a spectrum of actual belief. You know, I know many Jewish people who don't necessarily believe that there's a God, or, you know, that it doesn't matter, but they're still kosher and they're still following like the principles and practices and observing the holidays and the high holy days. And it doesn't matter if they believe that it's literally true, because it's not a faith that really prioritizes that. So even though we think we might associate the word orthodox with that, it's actually a faith that values orthopraxy, doing the right things. Mormonism is an interesting case, because both things really do matter, but to the extent that you don't preach about or share or kind of promote, as the church might say, your disbelief or your beliefs you have that contradict the church's official line, the church doesn't necessarily care or police that. You can believe that the Book of Mormon is an allegory and not literally true, and still be a faithful, tithe-paying, temple-going Mormon. As long as you're doing all the right things, then it doesn't matter so much what you believe. But once you begin to promote the things that you believe that are different from what the church teaches, that's when the church draws its line. And all of the excommunications that are mentioned in my book, and also sort of the things we've seen since then, have come mostly from people being on social media or being on the internet and kind of talking about their disbelief or their, you know, the things about the Book of Mormon or the history of the church or the church practices today that they don't agree with. And so that kind of speaking becomes an act in that case, and it's sort of still focus on doing the right things. And if you're promoting your belief that, you know, Joseph Smith was not really a prophet or whatever it might be, now you're acting in contradiction to what the church wants. So they're really the kind of disciplinary actions the church takes tend to focus on practice. It's a very practice-oriented faith, and, you know, keep your beliefs to yourself and you're fine. I actually had a very prominent apologist who worked with Fair Mormon at the time, now it's just Fair, who said to me, "You can believe anything you want, just don't tell anybody." Which, you know, like, oh, I mean, of course you can, like, no one would know. But what he really meant was that it's okay to have thoughts that, you know, maybe this isn't true or maybe this isn't literal, as long as you're still doing the right things. You know, you're still being a faithful, you know, you're doing your calling and you're paying your tithe, and then it doesn't make a difference. It's fine. And, you know, most of the time the questions that you're asked to be, you know, in a worthiness interview are going to focus on the your behaviors. You know, what are you doing? And are you breaking the law of chastity? Are you, you know, are you paying your tithe? What kinds of things do you do to show that you're faithful and that you're a good Latter-day Saint?
One of your chapters has to do with, I guess, new pressures challenges encountered by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This would not be unique to this church, but you're focusing on this church with explosion of information, which may or may not be correct, you know, may or may not be what the church wants out there, but it is out there in increasing amounts, and how the church has tried to deal with that. One of the things that struck me in that chapter is the difference between maybe older members and younger members. Younger members more used to getting this information and maybe not as affected by some of the information they're encountering out there on the internet.
Right. That's interesting. I've heard church leaders talk about that as having kind of an inoculation effect. Like if you're slowly exposed to some of these more controversial things over time, because, you know, you're just raised in the information age, then it's not going to come as a big shock to you to find out, you know, that Joseph Smith married another man's wife or anything like that. It's not necessarily surprising. A lot of the older people I've talked to were really raised in a culture where if a book was not published by the church or endorsed by Deseret News, then they wouldn't look at it. They wouldn't open it, because doing that was, crossing a line, a behavioral line, but also indicating like a lack of faith, because, you know, there's so much anti-Mormon literature and just reading it could cause you to doubt. So don't even read it. Don't even access it. Don't look for it. So, and without the internet, it's pretty easy to avoid some of that stuff. You know, if you don't check out those books at the library or have those conversations with people, then you're in a bubble, an informational bubble. But the internet kind of throws it in your face. If you want to be on social media so that you can stay in touch with your family, which we're all kind of, you know, trapped in that now. If you want to have that kind of social connection, then you're going to see it whether you want to see it or not. It'll show up in your feed. It'll be in your algorithm. And eventually you'll see some of that stuff that you may not have sought, but now it's sort of seeking you in a lot of ways. And if you do seek it, then it becomes, as I said, with my own experience in researching Mormonism, it becomes such a rabbit hole of possible things you can encounter. And I learned so much about archaeology by studying Mormonism, and I did not mean to, but, you know, you kind of follow the trails where they go, and there's so much documentation. BYU has focused so much on research related to archaeology and the history of the Americas. There's so much posted in forums and message groups, and just individuals who, you know, they have a life and a career that is not archaeology, but they spend a lot of time becoming a subject matter expert so that they can either defend the church's claims or challenge the church's claims on the basis of, you know, scientific evidence related to carbon dating, or, you know, whether there were wheels wheels for chariots in the Americas back when the Book of Mormon is meant to take place. Those kinds of questions are things that, you know, never really crossed my mind. And I imagine many Mormons who, you know, were raised with the stories in their own sacred texts, they probably didn't stop and think, you know, were there horses here or was there iron here? It's just not a question that comes up until suddenly it does. And then when it does, you kind of are overwhelmed with all of this information. And there are many people who've experienced massive crisis of faith by going through that kind of coming of age at the same time as the internet is making all of this so publicly accessible and easy to find. And I think, you know, people who are now 50 years old, I guess that's Gen X, right? Gen X was probably hit the hardest in terms of crises of faith occurring because of the internet. I would say boomer generation a little less so, because they could still kind of avoid it. They didn't dig in as much to internet subcultures and forums and social media groups at that time. And then, you know, now you've already mentioned, for millennials and Gen Z especially, kind of coming up in a world in which some of the stuff is already kind of common knowledge, I think it'll be less of an impact. Mm-hmm. But Gen X was hit pretty hard. I think membership kind of numbers, attendance numbers, those things probably would reflect that if we could see them.
Let's take another break, come back with a brief final segment. We're talking with Rosemary Avance. Her book is Mediated Mormons, Shifting Religious Identities in the Digital Age. We'll have more following this break.
I'm Julie Rose, host of the Top of Mind podcast. Every year in America, more than 30,000 people are injured by guns. Close to 45,000 die in gun violence. We're going to explore some options by breaking the problem down into its three components: homicide, suicide, and mass shootings. How can we reduce gun violence in America? It's Top of Mind.
Tune in Sunday morning at 9 here on UPR.
UPR will be in Springdale on Thursday, May 14th for a fundraising event at the Bit and Spur, and we'd love for you to support the station by attending. We'll have dinner and music, and our special guest will be former NPR Moscow correspondent Corey Flintoff. You'll also have an opportunity to bid well wishes to UPR's beloved hosts and station managers Tom Williams and Carrie Bringhurst, as they both prepare for retirement later in 2026. We hope you'll join us. Tickets are $75 and are available now at upr.org.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Rosemary Avance. The book is Mediated Mormons, Shifting Religious Identities in the Digital Age. Just have about 4 minutes or so in this very brief final segment. I want to have you, as brief, you know, briefly, but have you treat the presidential campaign of Mitt Romney, fascinating chapter. What is that presidential campaign? Tell us about these shifting religious identities in the digital age.
That is such an interesting case study. I know a lot of people have treated the, have looked at the treatment of Romney and his faith in the press and how the press sort of covered that. And I talk a bit about that in the chapter. What was really interesting to me was more how Mormons were talking about his faith. I was very interested to see the difference between more kind of progressive Mormon groups and more kind of conservative groups. And how they viewed him. There was some resistance to Romney's approach to, you know, talking about or not talking about his faith among conservative Mormons, who felt he wasn't talking about it enough. He had this national platform and he wasn't, you know, promoting the church as much or being, you know, what they saw as not being proud of his, you know, his Mormon story. At the same time, there were more kind of liberal Mormon critics who saw him as, not really representing what they see as true Mormonism, that his conservative social policies, for example, are not what they view as in the spirit of Joseph Smith's teachings and the teachings in the Bible about, you know, caring for the poor and those who are oppressed in our communities. So that there was sort of some resistance to his representation of Mormonism in the media and the public eye from both camps, from very conservative and very liberal Mormons, who both saw him as either, you know, not Mormon enough or too Mormon or, the wrong kind of Mormon. So that's such a fascinating, you know, the way we kind of police our own within communities to me is, you know, it's never surprising, but always interesting to see.
Just about a minute left. I wonder, just a takeaway question. What do you take away from these case studies, right, and having dived in deeply in some of these studies?
Yeah, well, I hate to think of it as history because, you know, to me it feels like all this just happened yesterday. But, you know, this is sort of a historical snapshot of a moment in time. And we are moving into a new one with generative AI and just some of the new technologies that are sort of taking over the ways that we communicate and get information. I think we're going to see some more shifts in how, some of the challenges to the church's authority and representations of Mormon identity as those shifts sort of take place and kind of take over how social media really communicates what we value.
Briefly, tell us what you're studying now. You told me before we went on the air. Fascinating.
Yeah, I have a lot of different interests, but I've always been interested in how people get a hold of information and what they have access to. And so right now I'm focused on rural communities and access to local news and information. Working on a project here in Oklahoma about citizen journalism and how community members can help contribute to the flow of information about their local communities.
Yeah, fascinating. We've been talking with Rosemary Avance, Assistant Professor of Media and Strategic Communications at Oklahoma State University. The book is Mediated Mormons, Shifting Religious Identities in the Digital Age. Rosemary Avance, such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
Look up, it's one sky, many cultures, as we delve into May and open the treasures of life on Earth. And we're asking a few sky watchers around here who love to look at the sky, what it looks like from different places around the world. This is neighbor and sky watcher Justin Daniels from Salt Lake City, talking about what it looks like to him from Hawaii and his impressions of other locations.
I think one of the coolest things I've ever seen, at least in regarding the night sky, is in Hawaii, the constellation Scorpio. When it rises, it's a hook that pulls the moon up out of the, they say it pulls the moon up into the sky, which I think is really cool.
And that's Maui's hook.
Yeah, Maui's hook, yeah.
Maui was a fisherman.
Right.
So he put his hook down and pulled up the moon and...
And islands, and according to the local folklore, you know, pulled up a lot of things.
Yeah. Probably pulled up a couple of fish, too.
Yeah, probably.
You were saying how it looks different from...
Yeah,
down there.
Yeah. I mean, the night sky is different, just mostly because here, especially with the North Star, Polaris, here I instinctively know where to look in the sky to find it. And the thing that stuck out to me so much there is that it's so much, being for that much further south, it's so much lower in the horizon, and you can't just find it like immediately like you can here.
It's kind of a weird juxtapositional thing. It's geographical, sort of almost a little emotional.
Yeah.
Just to see that you can tell you're somewhere else on the world.
That's right, yeah.
Where's your next travels?
So in a couple months, we're going to go to Costa Rica, and I'll give you an update when we get back from there, because I'm excited to see especially the moon, you know, looking sideways from what it looks like from here, which is going to, something you never, you know. Yeah, because if you go to the southern part of the world, southern hemisphere, you know, it looks upside down in our eyes because we're used to seeing it the same way the whole time. But when you're that close to the equator, it actually just looks sideways.
Wow, I can't even fathom that.
Yeah, it's gonna be something.
See the Southern Cross down there?
You will be able to, yeah. You're low enough that you can see the Southern Cross and a lot of the southern constellations that you'd ever get to see up here. So I'm excited.
All right, well, I'd be excited to get a report from you.
All right.
Can I get on board? I'm going to steal on your airplane.
That's it. I'll pack you up.
Kate Howells of the Planetary Society in an article from 2025 confirms that because of the Earth's curvature, the Moon orbits the Earth closely but not directly around the equator. The Moon does look different from the Earth's northern and southern hemispheres. So Justin's right. Someone looking at the Moon from our North Pole would see it upside down compared to someone seeing it from the South Pole. And someone on the equator would see it in various orientations throughout the day. Pretty exciting stuff. I want to get on a boat and go out in the ocean. And transitioning to low Earth orbit, those who listen to this show know that I can't resist going back to a novel called Orbit by Samantha Harvey once in a while. It's a fascinating look at what life is like from an astronaut's perspective aboard the International Space Station, which will be decommissioned and gracefully crashed in the ocean in a few years. Reasons given are aging modules, but throughout the run of the space station, modules have been fixed or can be replaced. We will lose the difficult-to-achieve scientific cooperation of multiple countries of priceless scientific study in favor of, I guess, profit. This is tragic in the view of this space reporter. In Orbit, this is the final passage in the book and is related as the station's orbit reaches its deepest edge where the auroras flicker across the Antarctica and the moon rises huge as a bicycle wheel and the stars explode on the horizon. Out there, electromagnetic vibrations ripple through the vacuum as bodies in space give out light. If these vibrations are translated into sounds, and the planets each have their own music, the sound of their light, the sound of their magnetic fields and ionospheres, their solar winds, the radio waves trapped between the planets and its atmosphere. Neptune's sound is liquid and rushing, a tide crashing onto the shore in a howling storm. Saturn's is that of a sonic boom of a jet. A sound that resonates up through your feet and between the bones. Saturn's rings are different still, a gale siphoning through a derelict building, but in slowed and warping tempo. Jupiter's moon Io makes the metallic pulsing hum of a tuning fork, and the Earth a complex orchestra of sounds and out-of-tune band practice of saws and woodwind, a spacey full-throttle distortion of engines, a speed of light battle between galactic tribes, a ricochet of trills from a damp rainforest morning, the opening bars of an electronic trance, and behind it all, a ringing sound, a fumbled harmony taking place, the sound of very far-off voices coming together in a choral mass, an angelic, sustained note that expands through the static. You think it'll burst into song, and this polished bead planet sounds briefly so sweet. It's light and in an ensemble of a trillion things which rally and unify her for a few short moments before falling back into the rin-tin-tin and jumbled tumbling of static galactic woodwind rainforest trance of a wild and lilting world. So look up, look around, and let's just get a little bit lost in space and on the Earth. Skywatcher Leo T.